This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Moms Talk Autism. We have two special guests today. You get two for the price of one, so stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
When you become a mom, you never imagine your child getting an autism diagnosis. It feels like your dreams have shattered, like a framed photograph falling off your mantle, exploding into a thousand pieces. But instead of trying to glue those pieces back together, this community of moms is here to help you build a new dream, a better one. So join in the conversation as us moms talk autism.
Okay, we are so thrilled to introduce our two special guests today. Jean, introduce these ladies to us, and we're so grateful she did. And I'm going to turn this over to Jean. This is Brittany, by the way. I forgot to introduce myself, but this is Brittany. As hopefully you know at this point, you've listened to me hundreds of times on here. Jean, why don't you give us a little bio on each of our guests today?
Yes. So I would say like this is kind of it's full circle how this all even came to be with our very esteemed guests that we have that I just happened to fall upon because we were running in the same avenues for advocacy here. So I first met our one guest, Peggy Hengel-Wolf, through work with Texas Parent to Parent. And at that point, Peggy had reached out and she said, you know, I wrote a book. I co-authored it with my friend. I want to tell you guys all about it. And that was Miss, well, are we PhD? Are we PhD?
Yes.
Dr.
Yeah.
Shala?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Dr. Shala Alahi, yeah. Rosales. So I'll dive in a little bit about your bio first here, Shala. You have your associate professor at the Department of Behavior Analysis at the University of North Texas. You've taught courses on ethics, early autism intervention, parent training, behavioral systems, applied research methods, technology transfer, and behavior change techniques. You've served on several boards and disciplinary committees. You've published and presented research on social justice, ethics, and early intervention, play and social skills, family, harmony, and supervision and mentoring. You have more than 4 decades of accumulated experience working with families and have trained hundreds of behavioral analysts, received awards for your teaching and work with families for your work in the community. And you currently are also teaching in the Middle East right now as a free.
Volunteer
position. Now allow you pro bono, to actually expand on that. It's a volunteer position, but for a very good purpose and very good cause. So that's very, very impressive. And also, you were one of the first BCBAs to get your boards here. You were number 75 in the whole world. So you are just...
I'm old.
Amazing. It feels like such an honor to be in your presence. Yeah. Well, listen, we love wisdom over here. I just drink it up. Okay. And Peggy, you were a previous author. You had written a book initially about your son, See Sam Run, which was a mother's story of autism. And you originally had that published in 2008 and by the University of North Texas Press. The book's manuscripts had won Mayborn Prize for Literacy and Nonfiction in 2005. And then for more than a decade, you had been exploring themes in autism and parenting and self-determination through your blog, which is PeggyHengel-Wolf.com. And You are an award-winning writer and journalist and hold a master's degree in journalism from the University of North Texas and a master's degree in music performance from the Eastman School of Music. And you are a social justice warrior. Both of you are, I mean, in your free time, in your professional work and, you know, all of the extra work that you do and right there alongside you. But you've certainly have blazed the trail. So thanks for being with us today, writing this wonderful piece of work here. When I dove into this book, I had a mentor when I started out on the journey, not immediately out of the gate, but not soon thereafter. And many of the things and the way that you are describing it and it could have literally came out of me and Jane's mouth. It was like you put words, things that were already in my head or had thoughts that have already been shared and felt so powerful. It's beautifully written book. Very, very, very happy that you walked into my life to share this with us. So I will turn it over to all of you and Brittany to guide us through the rest of the conversation.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we're glad to have you both on. And I will second Jean. I've also read your book and I've got little tabs all over it. I'm showing up on the screen. You can see at various points. And I love the way it is structured and it's broken down into three main sections. Let's say we've got a learning piece, we've got a connecting piece, and we also have a loving piece, and it's scattered throughout the book as well. But we really wanted to focus on the learning piece today, and discuss, because I think a lot of our listeners here today are starting out on their journeys. Maybe they have a diagnosis fairly recently, or they're even possibly working through that diagnosis process currently. And that learning part it can be very, very stressful and very overwhelming. Well, all of it can be, right? But the idea of, okay, I have this child and I have this diagnosis and I need to somehow reconcile those two things together in this person that I love dearly and want to care for, but I don't know what to do. And that's where that learning piece really can kind of come into play. And there's just so many different, it's very, very different. So I have a 17-year-old autistic child and I have a 9-year-old autistic child. And the differences and how both of them started out was vast. And that's because of a lot of resources as well available and the internet and just, you know, availability of things. So your book really focuses on maybe some of those early years of the autism process, of the history of it, really. And I like that you guys touch on that as a history nerd myself, and some of these programs and maybe how they came to be a little bit, you know. Out of all of the programs, I know, Shalat, you're really involved in ABA, right, as a BCBA and those programs and things. A lot of people usually start out there. So I would love to hear your thoughts on ABA, maybe currently, maybe how it's developed over the years, and what maybe we can do as parents now. What would be the best course of action starting off with ABA?
Well, so I want to jump in just for a second. Usually I let Shala answer first, but I think it's so exciting to hear that. So my son is in his mid-30s now, so it's not common. Autism was not common. So that whole start of the journey, what do I do now thing, was really difficult to deal with because there were very few resources in the community, and ABA was not a known and understood quantity. So the fact that you can start somewhere, I mean, it's important for people to know you can start somewhere, not just be at lost at sea. So, okay, Shala, go. I just, you know, that origin story part is so important. You actually do have a place to start. Trust the people who've built that much of the foundation because it's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Peggy. I think that's a good thing to remember. As I was focusing on, 17 and 9, how I was thinking about how has everything changed? And then thinking about, 30, the world has changed a lot. The world has changed outside of autism a lot, and the world has changed within the autism community a lot. And I think that was part of the reason we wanted to contextualize the progression of the science and the clinical and educational progress that's been made. But, all progress also comes with growth and growing pains. So I do believe it is like a blessing that there is a place to start. Absolutely. I think that for new parents, it also can be a little overwhelming. There's a lot on the internet. There's so many books and resources, which is wonderful. But as a new parent, that can also be overwhelming. Like, which choice do you make? And will it be the right choice for your child? And I think that is why, and I'm glad you're also focusing on learning first, is that part of what we talked about and reflected on as we were putting the book together is we really tried to think hard, like, what are the most important things a parent, that will help a parent navigate things in the best interest of their child and their family. And we settled on learning as the first one, is that you've got to be in learning mode. And there's a lot to learn. There are a lot of choices to make. There are a lot of times you're going to have to change your mind and go in another direction. There are times you're going to stay put. All of that requires learning. And you also have to learn how to learn. You need to learn what kinds of questions to ask providers, what kinds of things to look for to assure that your child not only will make progress, but that it'll be happy progress. They'll have a childhood. They'll learn better ways to interact and have agency in the world. And all of that is kind of complicated learning, which is why we added the connecting, because you can't do it alone. You really need to do what you're doing. In a way, this podcast and programs like this represent learning and connection because you are helping parents talk to each other, listen to each other, which is one of the best sources of learning. You're helping them know what kind of resources to go to, what kind of questions to ask. So I think that, yes, there is a starting point now because of the insurance reforms, because of progress in the discipline itself. But also, everything has grown really fast, which means when you go to scale that quickly, there's going to be some bumps in terms of quality. So that circles back and puts responsibility on the parents once again. Because in Peggy's day, there was a lot of responsibility on the parents, but now it's coming back, but in a different way. There's a place to start, but then you have to make decisions about the quality of that starting point and if it's the right fit for your child.
Absolutely. I want to mention in here, I'm going to read a little passage from your book. It says, a good treatment program will inspire growth that our child and family can sustain and build upon. Some of the program will include figuring out problems, but the rest will include much construction, discovering interests and building new skills and repertoires. Over time, our child should respond with more self-sufficiency and autonomy. So that's really the goal. That's like ideal situation, right? And then it's our job, our responsibility as parents to figure out what that program is. And it's not going to be the same program for every child. It's not going to be the same teacher. It's not going to be the same system necessarily. But there is overlap, and there is a lot of heft and knowledge to be gained from talking to other parents and therapists and professionals about that, and maybe trying some of those things out. So, Jean, go ahead.
So, I wanted to put a name to some of the things that you were saying, and just almost in connecting some of the concepts here. One, obviously, like, clearly, this is peer-to-peer support. There's nothing more powerful than that. And that is what we definitely want to amplify within this community. And, Peggy also doing work with You all, both of you, have done work with Texas Parent to Parent. That's how we now are all affiliated with each other. And I boast that as much as possible to get people connected, even to other parent-to-parent groups in other states. But you mentioned, especially in the beginning of the book, and this is where you're talking about those bumps. It's recognizing and understanding that autism has become an industry, and that now you're inside of that machine. And so when we're talking about the load on the parent, it's a commitment. It is a commitment from the parent, and Brittany and the girls and I have talked about that. For those of us have said that, yes, we are going to do ABA with our child. It's not a sit back and just be led around. You have to be fully participating. You have to be a full participant in the process and really be digging around and understanding what your child's targets, who those people that are working with your kids. That's part of the load that these parents are now carrying. And so it's almost like a shift and redistribution of mental and physical labor for the caregiver in this aspect, right? Because it's almost like now there's this abundance of saturation, and now to actually have to synthesize and comb through and distill what's out there, what is really a viable resource for our kids. That's where parents, I think, feel like that when they're using the terminology of "I feel lost," like, or "I don't know where to start," I think it's because then they just feel so overwhelmed by how much there is to know and how to figure out what is going to be good for them or not. So I just kind of wanted to name that, kind of congeal that a little bit.
That's the question then. In your expert opinion, both of you, throw it out. What are some signs and things that we should be looking for in an ABA program or any therapy program? What would you recommend? Where should a parent start?
You want to go first, Picky, or?
I only have like a basic concept, but it's not going to answer their question. When Sam was little and he didn't respond to me, I knew the first thing I needed to do was figure out how to respond to him so he would respond to me, so that we would get that back and forth that was so important. You know, I'd learn more stuff if he could imitate me. And if he wasn't imitating me, he wasn't going to learn stuff. And he wasn't going to imitate other people. So it's just understanding that your kid's going to respond to you differently than you expect. And if you can figure out ways to respond to them, you're just going down a different path. But there's exchange and reciprocity and response and action and consequence. It's all still there. It's just not what you expected. So anyways, and as a parent, you never give up that responsibility of responding and exchanging with your child. I don't know why I fixate on this, but I remember when Sesame Street said, "Oh, this is going to be so great. Kids of deaf parents will learn to talk from watching Sesame Street." And they didn't, because that's not where you learn to talk. You learn in exchange. You're motivated to exchange with the people around you. So that's why you're going to learn to sign first. You'll talk later. Because that's how it's happening in your family, you know. So it's a gross oversimplification. Yeah. But to illustrate the concept of, we want to have a relationship with each other. Okay, we got to figure out new ways of responding to each other.
Excellent.
And I will say that does it, it. Not only do you have to figure that out for your child, but then you have to figure it out. Like for my instance, I have two different children, two different ages, two different genders, two different communicative abilities. One is completely non-speaking, and the other has language, verbal language. So I have to then go. I have to figure out how to communicate differently for each of them. And then you're constantly adjusting. You give the analogy in your book of someone listening, you're driving across country and you're listening to an AM radio station and you're constantly having to tune the radio station to stay on course and be able to hear the music of whatever you're listening to, right? And that's what we have to do. Even at 17, my son, we are still really struggling with communication, and I'm constantly trying to tune that along with my team to help him communicate, because that is really key. If you can't communicate in whatever form that takes, then it's really difficult to learn and to progress and to be, you know, self-sufficient. So
I still want Shella to tell people how to be a good consumer, though. Yes. Well, we need that.
You know what, though? I think, and responsivity is a theme throughout the book. It is probably one of the strongest themes. But I think it's also important for me to still listen to Peggy and to you two about what is the first draw? What is the first most important heartfelt thing that you can see? Because I do have some ideas as a professional from kind of that side of things, what are kind of indicators or flags of things you should look for. But I think the responsivity fits in one of those. It is that when you are looking at places, look for a place that will help you increase your responsivity and your child's responsivity to the world in ways that are comfortable and expansive and happy. Like that's you want places that will help you do that. You also want places that will include you in the process. If you are not welcomed and included in the process, it might be a little flag about the levels or the dexterity of what they're doing, because the early research in this area showed us when parents are involved, children will flourish, children will do better, and families will be healthier and happier when everybody's involved. Now, you know, like all of us, we have a lot of responsibilities, both to our children, to work and all of that. So how the involvement takes place is a negotiated process. But the given should be that the parents and the family, however that's defined, is involved in the process and learns to be more responsive. I think that's central. I think the other thing I would look for, another indicator, is that you are welcomed into the spaces to see what it looks like and that there is time to talk to you and explain what's happening. You know, the place that you're going wants you to be an informed participant, that is important to them. They are transparent about what's happening, what they're doing, you know, and there's HIPAA and things like that, but there are confidentiality waivers where you can see what the process looks like. And I think that's another thing I would look for. In addition to welcoming the parent and responsivity, it's also, are you welcomed and is you being an informed participant sort of a priority? And then probably the third thing, I could probably say 10 things, but the third thing I'll end with is that I think what you want to look at is the goal and the emphasis of what they're doing, expansion of quality of life for the child and for the family unit. So is there effort and time put into, like what Peggy's talking about, teaching a child to imitate and learn from the environment, to communicate, to play, to expand their interests and how flexible they are in life about what happens. Like, and of course, one of the things that happens is children may have behavior that hurts themselves or hurt other people, and that absolutely has to be addressed. And you don't want that to be the only thing about your child, is the reduction and the contraction of behavior. You want it to be about the expansion of behavior, or at least the main emphasis, and the allocation of time should be primarily on that. I can stop there, and we go over some more things to look for. But I think
your opinion on this. Now I want to you
go.
You mentioned this in the book, which, by the way, make sure we mention the book's name. It's Responsible and Responsive Parenting in Autism Between Now and Dreams. So I don't think we may have
thank you. Yes,
mentioning the title, that again, because of, and this goes back to also in reference to how this has turned into a machine, is the box checking, and that people aren't just following a linear plan, because that then again eludes that erodes the possibility of expansion as well. You're limiting the child, and that's not our kids, especially our kids on the spectrum, are not linear learners. And so that's one thing that was huge red flags for me as a person, as a parent. I definitely stopped some BCBAs in their track. We shifted gears when that was sort of what their desire and direction was going. And because there was like, they could fall back in that. They could sit comfortable being like, oh, well, this is what the data, this is science-based, evidence-based, this is what we do. But that's not being then receptive to the child, and that's not curating the targets and the focus around the child. And that, for me, got me to look at how I was examining the treatment plan and not getting boxed into everything being prerequisite. Well, we need you to do this before we can move on to this. And that's not necessarily the case. So please, if you can expand on that, because I'm even seeing head nodding from both of you regarding that. Because I think that's a huge pain point. That's a huge thing that parents don't know that they need to look for.
I have a thought about that. That's a broader feedback than just like maybe my would be the goals and objectives with a BCA, but the goals and objectives that get set up when your child is in school. Hopefully your child is attending school, and there's all kinds of goals and objectives. When I was working on this book with Shala, we've been friends for a long time. And so my life is in a much more beautiful place because of our friendship and feedback and mutual connections. But every once in a while, I would learn something from her that I would go, I wish I'd known this 20 years ago. And we were relaying a story of one of the vignettes in the book is a story of a kid who had hundreds of goals for a year, not just five. And if you have a plan that has five goals with all kinds of prerequisites and we're only going to get this much accomplishment, that you probably, I mean, to me, that's a flag that you're probably in a checklist mode and you're not setting up a rich environment that has all these amazing things happening that lets your kid grow in all the many and varied ways that they can grow. Kids grow so fast. They pick up stuff so fast. It doesn't, the things that hung Sam up weren't as big of a deal when I look back now as they felt like at the time. So because he was picking up all kinds of other stuff along the way that they're his strengths now. So that dude can fix. It's like no one taught him that. Where did that come from? So I don't mind him rewiring something in the laundry room because I know it'll be to code.
You know, I think this idea about evidence-based practice, you know, and what you said, Jean, about when you paused and said we need to not approach it this way, that I think in the best case, evidence-based practice is, yes, you look at the best available research evidence, but you also look at that little human being and what they need and under what conditions. And then there's a process of wisdom that joins the two together. But that wisdom has to come from both the practitioner, the clinicians, and the family. Like everybody needs to be figuring out how things fit and under what conditions we can keep making progress. Because I think one of the things that Peggy alluded to is we talked about different cases where either progress was being made or not made or somewhere in between. All of us have to be vigilant that progress has continued. And for some kids, it may look very different than other kids, like the degree of the type of progress, you know, but everybody in a good program should be making progress. No matter what their baseline or starting level is, they should be moving from baseline. And that is the biggest red flag. If you see movement that is destructive, that is not meaningful, that is not generalized, that's a flag. Something needs to change, that you have to relook at the evidence. You have to relook at the conditions and change what's happening. And I think that takes the families and the professionals doing that together.
I wanted to use an example here, and then I would like Brittany actually to give a reflection on that too, because part of her experience with her older child's treatment, I feel like Brittany felt like he kind of plateaued, or there was no other, more progress being made, right? A block that I was reaching was, again, that the way to assess, the rubric to assess verbal acuity was using the VB map when we started out. And he had rapidly moved through most of the domains of that, but there was this last smidge. And one of the clinicians was adamant that I'm not moving him to ABLES until he completes that. Yeah. And I was like, and here's what was happening too, was that then they kept recycling in maintenance for, again, trying to generalize things that we already previously mastered. We were seeing uptick in aggression behavior. I want to give like these kind of real life examples because to identify it, because that's parents come into our DMs and they're asking us this, like, how are they discerning this information? And so for me, like everything that you're saying right there, that's the perfect example of that, right? Of like, that was a red flag to me. And I had a cousin-in-law that was a BCBA. And she was saying that some clinicians are adamant to stay in that until they complete one part of a rubric, they won't move on to the next one. And I can tell you from my personally lived experience, I'm vehemently against that for my own child. I've seen him, I mean, as soon as we got a new clinician and we moved to the ABLES and we just threw out, like, he then, you know, the rest of that gap or whatever was, it filled itself up eventually. Like, we could still refer back to it, but we weren't using that as a target anymore. And I'm saying that just because, again, even in my DMs yesterday, I have a parent actively trying to figure out some behavioral targets and like, well, what does this mean? You know, and how to examine how the clinician's lens is operating, where their operating space is coming from, more or less. So
I'm going to take this first. I think I was looking for an article. I'm going to put it in the chat so you can share it with people. But I strongly, strongly believe in multidimensional analysis and multidimensional assessment. So staying in one assessment zone like that is thwarting. It's the opposite of thriving. And I think if you're not looking on multiple dimensions, listening to the parent, having other assessments that complement in different ways, I think that getting stuck happens a lot. So I think from the professional point of view, it's the same thing as with the family. You have to be in learning mode and connecting mode. So that young professional or that novice professional who's staying without understanding the context of it and understanding why you do an assessment and what an assessment gives you and how to look at other things, I think that young professional also needs to connect and find out more about how to have continuous improvement and movement without a child, those things happening. You know, I also think, you know, part of the insurance mandates is reliance on particular tools. And part of what I'm seeing, which is lovely, the new behavior analysts learn, is that there are other tools that are really helpful. Like there's the Hawaiian Early Learning Profile. There's the Vineland, which most of them use. There's play-based assessment, but there are ecological assessments. There are multiple ways to assess, and then you make decisions based on those multiple levels, not just one mastery criteria for one assessment tool, because the child is more than the assessment tool. The assessment tool is just to help you figure out what to do and where to go. But if you're stuck, you need more help. You need more assessment. You need to move. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that that is what happened, but I hope other parents hear it and learn. You know, you see a flag, advocate.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
That's a really, really good point. And I wanted to bring up something that you chat about in the book. I don't want to give away everything in the book because we want people to buy the book and read it for themselves. But this really brings into to light the whole idea of a whole system thinking that you mentioned. And like Jean's example is a great example. I have examples of myself with my son, especially of who knows more, right? The professional or the parent. And as a parent, especially when you're starting out, if you don't have exposure to autism or, you know, applied behavioral analysis or any of these buzzwords that were, or these, you know, definitional words that we're describing and these therapies that are available, you are learning as well. You are gaining that, you know, that honorary degree in these areas of your life. And it's difficult to know. You have to navigate, okay, I'm hearing what this person is saying. They're saying that we need to, we can't move on until we do this. Do they know more than I do? How do you make those decisions? And that's a very general, broad question, but I'd love to hear maybe some thoughts from each of you about how, what parents can do to maybe exercise that muscle and gain that experience and that knowledge. And that's really, that's the biggest thing, is you just kind of have to learn and do it and exercise a try. But what other things could they possibly do to feel more confident in their decisions working with professionals?
Oh gosh. Okay. I guess I have to take this one. So, it's really difficult because we're taught very early on to defer. And deference is a social skill, and deference has its strengths. And there are things you can get from deference, but we're not taught early on how much parents really know. We really like to bring in all the experts. For all kinds of things. And that's just someone who got to do their 10,000 hours on something or whatever. That's actually kind of hard, but that's what Malcolm Gladwell said it took to become an expert was 10,000 hours on something. I'm pretty sure with a newborn, you feel like you've already given your 10,000 hours at 2 months old, but you have to use the muscle, and your kid needs you to use the muscle. So if it always helped me to find the courage to know that Sam needed me to do this for him, to stick up for him until he could figure out how to do it himself. I like to think about all kinds of systems. So in an IEP meeting at school, the teachers and the therapists might actually understand this system they're in much better. They may have expertise in the system that has powerful implications for what we're going to plan to do in terms of available resources and time and goals and such. But we're an expert on the system that sustains. So if something is, if we're trying to do things that are going to last forever, that's the system I run, the system where the child lives, the system where the child is growing up. If it's not sustainable in my house, it's not going to last. So, but like any other muscle, if you don't use it, it's not going to get strong. I never brought in anybody to go with me to an ARD meeting to advocate on behalf of us. That practice that's happening now with young parents befuddles me. It says more about the school district than it does about the parents, honestly. But you want to get strong for yourself, and you want to demonstrate that so that when your kid starts coming up to that age, they're able to advocate for themselves. They, advocacy has to be sustainable too.
I want to add something to that because I thought a lot of, and Peggy and I have talked for decades about this issue. You know, there's an advantage to being in my 60s, both as a parent and a professional, is that I can look back and reflect in different ways than I could when I was a young professional and a young parent. In both cases, I hope, I have evolved, I have learned, I look back and think, oh my, why did I do that? Or, oh, that was really good, I did that, I learned that. But it was definitely a learning journey in both cases. And I think that's one of the important things to remember is everyone is learning. Everyone is learning under these conditions and everyone has something to bring to the situation about the system. It may be more or less levels of knowledge, but I think also, and I guess I want to say this in particular for young mothers, because in the course of my career, this is where I have seen things that are the most distressing, is that I believe, even if they don't have the words and they haven't learned all the things to do, I have seen young mothers have a gut feeling about something, about what to do, what not to do, what feels wrong, what feels right. And I feel like part of everybody's task is to help them articulate and identify that and understand why they're feeling that way and then take action, because it almost always is on point for one reason or another. And I think the way society is, that is the one population. And then add to it a young mother who is Black or Latino or, you know, not from the dominant religion, add all those intersections, and then they're even more doubted and not listened to. So including by themselves, by ourselves, like I think of all of us being young mothers, and I'm guessing we didn't always have confidence about what our gut feelings were about things. And we didn't have people around us who helped us figure out why we were feeling that way. So I guess that's the one thing I would add, is that if all of us can support young mothers to help learn how to feel confident, to speak those things out loud, so we can all figure out what are the conditions that lead to that feeling.
Peggy, I wanted to expand on what you mentioned about like this movement, or we'll call it a movement, this trend with what the IEP and our meetings look like now with younger parents. I didn't show up with an advocate with me at the table. I did show up with my BCBA eventually. The kid's dad wasn't coming with me and I showed up my BCBA. Behind the scenes, I had a legal advocate that was functioning as like an advisor to me, right? And he was saying, like, you want to bring your posse. You want to have a posse. You want to have people there, even just for the optics. You don't have to say a thing. You just want to have a posse, because I think the thing is that they seem outnumbered. And then what a thing that I say often for parents is that advocacy is a muscle. So you do need to practice that muscle, and that muscle is built over time. This is an endurance, like just thinking about a marathon. You are now an endurance athlete in the field of advocacy now, and that's a hard thing. And so that difference that you mentioned, and those disenfranchised groups, those intersectionalities that you mentioned, what I also take note of is that not only do they not feel heard, but culturally where they've come from, their heritage tells them we do automatically defer. And so there's cultural norms within all those intersectionalities that lend to that being the case. And so I loved both of your explanations on those takes, because these are concepts that come up all the time. I'm wondering, why is this happening? And some of it is there can be dysfunctionality. Obviously, no school district is perfect. But some parents do need that. Sometimes, again, they just need to know that person's there, kind of like a doula. Yeah. It's kind of like you know, just a body in the room. Like you need that. It's like an energy source, but it, they're not saying anything kind of thing. So it, I think it, there's a lot of mixed things going on because there's a lot of one, the eligibility, the kids that are being identified now, all of those things have increased. And so you're seeing the rise in numbers in special education, which is good. But the system is overloaded because there's a lot of vacancies as well. So then you're seeing that. So there's creating more disparities and more gaps. And it's becoming harder to navigate if you don't have all that context and you don't know. Like, it's insane. Literally, I have a million tabs open in my head right now. Hands up. but yeah, I love
it. I love the idea of a doula. I'm starting to riff on that. Like a doula for families. Like, geez. It's different than an advocate. It's different than a professional. It's, but the idea of a doula, because there's so much emotional labor, you know, intellectual labor, physical labor, and parenting in general. And yes. Then you add on to yes. It having to navigate it in all different ways. I love the idea of a autism family doula or something. I'm going to think about that. That's good. Yes, I love
it. You heard it here first, folks. Yes. Yes. All right. Well, we will wrap up our conversation today. I would like to ask both of you, as we've had this conversation, if there's anything that you would like to say to parents relating to the subjects we've covered or something completely different that you think it's important for them to hear, whether they're just starting out or maybe they're doing a reset. You know, we've taken a look at all of this and it's just not working. We need to figure out a new plan. If there's anything else that you would like, advice that you would like to share with our audience today.
Well, I'm not the source of the advice, but I know that there's people I would go to. So first, just remember you've got this and you've got a network of people around you. Ask for help.
I think that's great. Yeah. Asking for help and building up. We always talk about diversifying your portfolio, you know, whether that's in friendships or in your professional, that team that is working with your child and asking for help in various areas of your life. You know, just to touch on really quickly, the IEP, I've had, my parents do not live near me. They're very involved in my children's lives as much as they can be. We do not live in the same state, but we had a key IEP, a transitional IEP meeting coming up. And this was years and years and years ago for my son. And I knew what I needed to do. I knew what I needed to ask for. I knew what I wanted, but my husband could not come with me to that meeting. And so my mom flew out and came with me. She knows, I mean, I'm talking to her on the phone about these things, right? Like she kind of has a general idea what's going on. She's never been to an IEP meeting before. She's never heard, she doesn't know half the jargon, right? Not really. But she was just there and she was my doula for that meeting, right? And it was really, there was her reactions after, which was a whole nother subject, but my confidence grew, not because she was going to be able to help me say all the right things and advocate in the right way necessarily. But I had someone there with me and I asked for that help, right? And she was able to come out and help me with that, just being there. And if that's all you have right now, because you don't know anything and your best friend doesn't know anything, and use that source, just having that person next to you, whether that's researching or at an IEP meeting or interviewing an ABA company, have someone there that you can interact with that can maybe help you navigate some of those things and see it in a different light. So yeah, I love that, asking for help.
You know, today, I think the thing I would say is we talk about emotions a lot in the book and how emotions are flags for different situations, different contingencies. And one emotion we focus on is joy finding. And I think that it is hard when you're panicked and afraid and something is new and you don't know what's happened to forget the joy, to forget to nurture the joy. And I think this beautiful child you have, there will be wonderful moments. The progress will be a different type of progress. But even the people you meet on this journey, like the people that I've met with my own kids' needs, as well as other people's needs, like are some of the deepest friendships I have in life. And they're people who love my children. And I think that it's easy, again, just like the therapy, to focus on what's just incredibly difficult and needs to be addressed, but also focus on the construction of a beautiful life, because it's very possible for all of us. And I think that joy finding is keep pursuing that and building that muscle also for your child, for yourself, for the people around you.
Yeah. And there'll be ebbs and flows to that, right? There'll be times where it's easier to find that, or that you're in a better headspace to find that. But it is important to keep coming back to that and returning to that. I completely agree. I'm a huge advocate of that. And that's something we try to emphasize on here. That's why we are doing this podcast, is for those relationships, like you said, is for the opportunity to reach out together. And we are not, none of us live in the same state, the four of us. We don't get to see each other very often. It takes a considerable amount of effort for us to be in the same physical space. But we make the effort every day to, we have the business and we're talking about this podcast and we're working. It is a full-time job. I'll let everyone know. Like, if you've never done a podcast before, it's a lot of work. But we are also taking the time to try to connect personally and just be in each other's spaces and see each other's kids on our phones virtually, but still seeing them and being together. And if you can have that in your life, in addition to all these other things that you're trying to navigate, it will enrich and you will be able to find that joy. So thank you for bringing that up.
Can I say,
Jean, any closing thoughts?
I do, but I
just want to say,
Thank you.
We started recording during, like, I see how you're giving each other energy, how you give each other power, how you smile, how you laugh, that I see that. And I see that in the other podcasts that you've done, or I hear it. But anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just want to say you really are a demonstration of joy finding. And I think, and other kinds of finding too, advocacy, knowledge, information, but you definitely are joy finders. And that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, I will actually tell you that Brittany and Shannon are the pinnacles of our sunshine. They have the amazing ability to couch and curate mindset and language around literally the worst scenarios and make it, it's not that they're necessarily using flowery language. I'm not even saying that, because they will be very vulnerable and authentic, but there's just this grace about them being able to do that, where Tosh and I are at odds with ourselves because we have to combat our anger first before we can get to that. But there's a place for us too. You know, there's a place
absolutely
for us too. You know, so we're a great little woven blend of personalities here, and our lived experiences, where our kids are, like our backgrounds, just everything before we had kids. Like, there's such diversity there. There's a huge focus again on defining what diversity actually is in other domains of my life. And so this just even brought that fuller circle. And what I was going to say is, we've had, my closing remarks were that we've had other expert guests, we've had other authors on this podcast. And we just recently had a series of episodes with a researcher, and that was those were enriching, very robust conversations, and many of which, that feedback that I had gotten, and then people that have said, oh, and now I bought the book and all that stuff. It is there. I mean, he is by definition a researcher, and I'm a geek about that. I love that. But what your book touches on, many of the themes, and in fact, it edifies personally lived experiences of his ground research, further and like bolsters that, and it gives the lived experience a heartbeat. There's vulnerabilities in this book that then our community can like grab onto and hold. You know, it's not just data or a reference point. Like, there is a synergistic, like, you guys didn't meet professionally. This wasn't just two professionals writing the book. You were right. The first step was, you were friends. The origin of it, we were friends, and everything else is secondary to that. You just happen to be professionals and have all these other personally lived experiences. So sometimes it's the flip, right? It's those things first, and then, you know, professional, then every personal, but for personal is first. And so that's the difference, I would say, about this book that makes it even really significant and powerful and impactful for anyone reading it, especially our families.
Thanks for seeing it, and thanks for knowing it. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah, we love this. This has been a wonderful conversation. Whatever you two are willing to share, if someone would like to contact you or learn more about you, how can they do that? If they'd like more information.
You can go to my blog, peggyhinklewolf.com. And I also have a redirect to my blog at betweennowanddreams.com. And you can message us there.
That would be great. We will definitely link the book as well. Once again, the full title is Responsible and Responsive Parenting in Autism, Between Now and Dreams. You can buy it on Amazon. You can get it from local booksellers. Hopefully we always, try local first, please. But, if you can't, go to the big guys, and, it's a great little book. It's like literally a little book too. I like that. I like how pocket size it is. So, we really appreciate you being on today and having this discussion with us, answering questions and sharing your knowledge and expertise. And as Jean said, your heart, which is, the most important part. So thank you, everyone. If you need to reach us, we are at Moms Talk Autism. Just Google that in and things will pop up. So we've got the website, we've got the Instagram, we've got the podcast, and our email is at hello@momstalkautism. If you have questions for either of these lovely ladies, you can send them. I'm the one who usually checks the emails. You can send them to me and I will forward them on, and we can continue conversations, especially if it's something specific that you'd like some more information on. So thank you for being here today, and we will see you next time.
Thank you.